Welcome to the very exciting first ever Thought podcast. And we do have another event coming up. We'll tell you more about that at the end, or search Thought on Eventbrite to find us. This talk was recorded at our first ever Thought event on the 18th of October 2019. It was delivered by Dr. Dennis Alexander, who has chaired the Molecular Immunology Programme and headed up the Laboratory of Lymphocyte Signalling and Development at the Babraham Institute in Cambridge. So he is quite a bigwig in the world of genetics. He has also written several popular science books, and he co-founded the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion at Cambridge University. He certainly seems well qualified to answer our question. Is evolution atheistic? Here he is, doing just that.
You know, I just was thinking, as Amy gave that great talk earlier on, actually, that I know that not everyone here is a biologist. Okay, are we? I don't think not everyone here is a biologist, right? But so I thought we'd better just start out, my bit anyway, thinking about what is evolution, okay, from a biological perspective, because unless we get that, unless we're all starting from the same page, then really, we can go off in different directions. So I like to start out actually by saying what evolution isn't, right? So evolution is not a philosophy. Okay, people have made philosophies out of it, but it's not primarily a philosophy. It's not some ideology in support of atheism, although, as we've just been hearing from Amy, there are people who want to go in that direction as well. Simply from I'm a biologist, by the way. I should have introduced myself a little bit. I spent 40 years in the biological research community, not specifically working in evolution, but you know, evolution is simply the background for us biologists. It's the framework within which we carry out all our research, our biomedical research, and so forth and so on. Okay. And for us, it's simply the best explanation that we have for all the biological diversity in the world. And it's that simple, really. And Amy's already shown you this lovely sort of picture that Darwin came up with, you know, the whole thing about a tree of life. And, of course, if you read the Origin of Species, you'll hardly find the word evolution in there, actually. It's mentioned once on the last page. But the phrase that Darwin liked was the phrase descent with modification, because he had this great concept of a tree. So everything has a last common ancestor. If you go back each branch, you go back and back and back and back and back like that. And, of course, the other thing, as we look at that, which, of course, Darwin didn't really know, is that we all living things, we are all united. We all have a history together. In fact, I think it was Darwin's brilliance to bring history into biology. It's, in a way, it's a historical thing, isn't it, this tree. But also, of course, we now know that we're all made of stardust, as you often hear. We're all made of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, all the elements that make up all living things all around the world. We've all got the same DNA code, plus or minus the odd difference, but pretty much bacteria to us and yeast and all the rest. We've all got the same DNA code. So really what evolution emphasizes is this great unity that we have, all of life together. And often it's likened to, the tree of life is likened to the evolution of languages. In fact, if you can do a language map like the one shown there, and if you go back into all the different languages, if you want to know, I don't know, what was the last common ancestor between German and Dutch, for example, you go back and back and back, and you find, oh, it's Old Saxon. Okay, so the way that that languages develop as well is a little bit analogous, really, to the way we think about it in biology. And, of course, the reason that we biologists like evolution is simply it just explains so much. It makes things coherent that otherwise would be incoherent. And so lots of these bits of pieces up there, you know, when Darwin was doing his great voyage around the world on the Beagle, his famous voyage, there were lots of different things that he knew about, lots of biologists knew about, but they weren't really sort of joined up, fossils and anatomy. He didn't know about genetics, of course, certainly geography, physiology, geology, genetic fossils, all those kind of things. And in a way, what a big theory does is to join everything up. It makes it like a map. And so Darwin's theory joins up all these data and makes them coherent. And that's really what science is about, is trying to go out there, find data, and then make a story that's a coherent story that joins it all up so we can understand it better than we could before. Just looking, we obviously haven't got time for, you know, all the evidence for evolution, all that kind of stuff here this evening. Just looking at one of those words, vestiges. You know, what do we really mean by a vestige? And I like this example, actually. In fact, I saw this example fairly recently. I was in Australia and going around a natural history museum. And if you look at the baleen whale hanging up there, if it's a good museum, you'll see this tiny little vestigial hind leg bone, which is stuck. You can hardly see it there, can you? But right down there. Sorry, this doesn't shine on the screen, but right at the back, okay, there's a tiny little hind leg bone. And in fact, about one out of 500 of these baleen whales actually have a rear leg that protrudes outside, you know, the body wall. And that's a vestige of the evolutionary past, because, of course, whales were once mammals. They lived on the land, and they had legs, okay? They came in the sea. Well, if you don't use them, you're going to lose them, okay? So that's what happened with whales. But they still got this vestige. And in fact, if you look at our own DNA, and we're all actually walking fossil museums here this evening, in a way, from a DNA perspective, because we all contain our evolutionary past written into our DNA code. You don't even need physical fossils now. We've got genetic fossils that tell us so much about our background and about history, and that's really, I think, very fascinating. So, of course, evolution's come a long way since Darwin. Darwin knew one of the bits of it, but not the other bits. And it's really now, just to summarize briefly, it's got two steps, two phases, if you like. Step one is you've got all the variation that comes into our DNA. That's called the genome. Genome is simply the sum total of all the information in our DNA. And that change, the changes can come about through many, many ways, through sexual reproduction, through mutations, through genes getting duplicated, more than a dozen ways, actually, in which variation can come into our genome. We should be happy tonight about the variation in our genome, otherwise we'd be a big clone, we'd all look the same, and life would be really boring. Okay, so I'm happy about that variation. So then that's sort of step one in the whole evolutionary process. Then step two is this kind of filter of natural selection. And that's the filter, the natural selection bit is what Darwin really discovered and wrote about in his great book, The Origin of Species, 1859. And what you get there is that all these different little lions, those little lion cubs, they're all slightly variant. And their genomes, if you like, within them are being tested out in the workshop of life to see which one really does best and which one is more likely to pass on its genes eventually to succeeding populations. And that's known as reproductive success. Simply, it's a numbers game. It's how many, we're talking about animals here, you know, how much of their genes are passed on to the next generation and so forth. If you want a nice little summary, oversimplistic, but nice little summary of what evolution entails. GIP, genetic variation happens, individuals are selected, that's really important. Individuals are selected, populations evolve. Okay, it's a nice, easy way of remembering what evolution is really about. Okay, so now let's come back then to the question we have this evening. Is there any particular reason why we should consider this whole process atheistic? Darwin clearly would have said no to that. And here's a letter. We got wonderful letters from Darwin, mostly in the Cambridge University Library, wonderful collection. But you can also look at them online if you like reading his letters, hundreds and hundreds of them online you can access. Okay, Darwin writing to John Fordyce, 1879, it seems to me absurd to doubt that a man may be an ardent theist and an evolutionist. In my most extreme fluctuations, I've never met an atheist, never been an atheist, in the sense of denying the existence of a God. Okay, that's pretty clear. And then if you go actually back one year, but he's writing to someone called Henry Ridley, 28th of November, 1878. Quote, Dr. Pusey, the Oxford divine, he was a theologian from Oxford in those days, was mistaken in imagining that I wrote The Origin with any relation whatever to theology. I should have thought that this would have been evident to anyone who has taken the trouble to read the book. Close quote. And I think, I think he had a real point there. You know, anyone who reads The Origin of Species will realize it really has nothing to do with evolution. What I find really, really fascinating is this. So Charles Darwin sent out advanced copies of The Origin of Species several days, even some weeks before it was actually published. It was published on the 24th of November, 1859. So here he sent out one of these copies to a great friend of his, the Reverend Charles Kingsley, who was writing them back to him here to tell Darwin what he thought about the book. So this is written, as you notice, on 18th of November, 1859, 6 days before the official publication of the book. And this is the first written evidence, first written report historically that we have of a response, The Origin of Species, written by an Anglican clergyman, right? Okay. And he writes, Charles Kingsley writes, It is all I have seen of it awes me, referring to the book. It is just as noble a conception of deity, of God, to believe that he created primal forms capable of self-development as to believe that he required a fresh act of intervention to supply the lacunas, that's the gaps, which he himself had made. Close quote. It's a fascinating quote. Actually, Darwin liked it so much that he put it right at the front of the second edition of The Origin of Species. Darwin corresponded with hundreds and hundreds of clerics in the 19th century because they were the natural historians of the day. They had wonderful collections of beetles and, you know, butterflies, all kinds of things, because they had plenty of time to do it. Okay, they were out in the countryside, you know, nice living, got a nice salary, plenty of time to do collections of stuff. And that's how they ended up. A lot of their work actually ended up in The Origin of Species. You have to remember that most of the science in this country until late in the 19th century was taught by Anglican clerics. Okay, so it's good to remember that. Science teaching, that's where it came from. So I've held, by the way, I held this letter from Charles Kingsley with trembling hands. I've held the letter in my hands in the great collection. Of course, my hands with plastic gloves on, as you can imagine. But anyway, I just love that letter. Anyway, so why is it that, you know, some people today should think that evolution is atheistic in some way? Well, we've already been hearing a little bit from Dawkins. Here's my quotes from Dawkins to make the same point Amy's already made, who says, "I pay religions the compliment of regarding them as scientific theories, and I see God as a competing explanation for facts about the universe and life." And then I always remember this Channel 4 program with Darwin. He said, "Darwin removed the main argument for God's existence." So in other words, here we've got, you know, science or God. You have one explanation or the other in some way, and these are in some competition. And, of course, it is science that wins every time. That's sort of Darwin's way of looking at things. So let's now think now, is there a sort of more useful way of looking at different forms of human knowledge? I want to give you a little model. It's very simple, actually. But just to make this point, there are many ways of knowing. There are many ways of knowing, okay. And so I want you to imagine for a moment that the whole of reality, this book of life, if you like, is like a cube, and it's just got many, many different levels in it, and each level represents one particular way of understanding the world, okay. So we can run down them. These are not in any particular order. I don't think that science has got to be the most important because I've got to put it on the top. Actually, I had a version of this model where they're all vibrating up and down, up and down. And then we had a problem with one or two epileptic people in the audience. Anyway, it was bad news. So we had this is stable. Okay, there's a problem with any model. It has to be stable. So level one, we're going to say, yeah, it stands for scientific information. What are we trying to do? We're trying to find out the properties of the problem, the generalizations we can make about the properties of matter. We're going to try and find out about laws, scientific laws, how things work, mechanisms, all that kind of stuff, what we publish in scientific journals. Then we've got another level. Of course, that's very important, the ethical level. What ought we to do with the information that we discover? How ought we to behave in the world and so forth? How ought we to apply the new great scientific discoveries and so forth? And we've got level three there, the aesthetic level. We've got this understanding, what counts as beauty in the world? We look at a painting, we look at a picture, we go to a theatre, we go to a film. How do we judge that to be beautiful? That's a different kind of discourse, isn't it? It's a different kind of knowledge that we gain. And then we've also got our own personal knowledge. Obviously, that's the knowledge that's most important to us. That's our own autobiographies. It's what we experience day after day. And it's not scientific knowledge. It's just that personal experience we have of life and relationships and what happens in life. Different kind of knowledge. And then, of course, we've got these great religious questions we've been thinking about this evening. Why is there a universe anyway? The one that Stephen Hawking questioned, the late Stephen Hawking used to ask, what breathes fire into the equations? Why is there a universe? Why does it bother to exist? Okay, how ought I to live my life? Does God exist? I mean, these great religious questions. The point about this very simple model is to point out, look, there are many different ways of knowing and understanding the world. And we need them all, actually. If we're going to do justice, some justice, to the complexity of the world, we need all these different forms of knowledge. And there's no necessary reason why any of them should be in particular conflict. They might be, but there's no reason to expect why they should be. And, of course, we also have to remember that this is one reality. I'm putting lots of yellow arrows there, because our Faraday Institute in Cambridge, actually, which I'm still involved in, is very much concerned, you know, how do the different disciplines, how do the different arrows join up, the different levels of information and so forth, that kind of thing. But if you think about it, also, this is how our universities are structured, isn't it? Because they have different disciplines and different, you know, different faculties and so forth and so on. And each one has its own particular way of understanding the world and justifying its beliefs. So you go to the law faculty, it's going to have a different way of justifying its beliefs compared to a little bit similar to history, but it's going to be different from history. My own field is biochemistry, it'll be different from biochemistry, and so forth and so on. You know, we all have our different ways of understanding the world, taking a slice out of reality and then trying to help put all those slices together to seek to understand things better. So in a way, then, I see that as a very different view from the one that Dawkins is trying to present to us. He's trying to say, well, you know, these theological explanations are in some kind of rivalry to scientific explanations. And I just don't think they are, you know. And when you come and look at the concept of God that Dawkins has anyway, it's sort of more like a kind of Superman plus, you know, it's like a, that's why I put a Superman there, but, you know, it's got this sort of sense that it's really a human creation. And I think the important point here is that the God that Christians believe in is extremely different from that. So I want to sort of move on a little bit now to thinking about what we understand really in Christian theology by this little word creation. We've been thinking about creationism. But what actually do we, I mean, how do Christians go about thinking about creation? And what I'm going to tell you now is probably, I'm sure, nothing new to a great majority of people here, and I'm not going to tell you anything that's hasn't been around for thousands of years, okay? So we can go to the Bible, look at the biblical literature, what did the early church fathers say, what about if we come to the 13th century, the great thinkers like Thomas Aquinas, people like that, reformers like Calvin, more recent theologians. So what I'm going to just give you now is a little potted history, really, of how we can sort of express and think about this whole understanding of what we mean by God as creator. Now, like I say, we're not thinking about God here as some sort of rival explanation to scientific explanations. That's not what we're thinking about. Basically, when we're thinking about God as creator, we're thinking about God as the origin, the source behind everything that exists. Okay, I've just put a nice little complicated equation there. You know, just to make the point, it doesn't matter what we're talking about that exists. It could be rabbits, it could be you, me, it could be the laws of nature, it could be the 10 to the 22 stars in the whole universe. It doesn't really matter. I mean, if it exists, then in this view, God is the mind and the source, the author behind all that exists. Authorship, I think, is quite a nice picture here, in a sense, you know, if you're reading a book, the book has one author, and, you know, that is the author of the whole book, okay? And so that's perhaps a nice little picture way of thinking about what we understand of God as creator. And here we're going to do a little bit of heavy theology, I'm sorry about this, for late on a Friday evening, just a couple of points here, which I think underlies how different is the sort of Christian understanding of creation from our daily use of the word. The problem about the daily use of the word human creation is, of course, that when we create things, we're starting with materials already created, aren't we? We've got a potter, we're making a pot out of the clay and so forth. But God's creation is quite different. And I like this quote. This is actually a guy called Bill Carroll, who's a theologian mostly in Oxford. He roams around the world. As he always tells me, he roams around the world talking about nothing. And I'll explain that in just a moment, okay? Okay, so, quote, and this is where it gets a little bit heavy, so we'll go slow on this, okay. God's causality, this is Bill Carroll, God's causality is so different from the causality of creatures that there is no competition between the two. That is, we do not need to limit, as it were, God's causality to make room for the causality of creatures. God causes creatures to be causes. So creation is not essentially some distant event, rather it is the ongoing complete causing of the existence of all that is. At this very moment, were God not causing all that is to exist, that would be nothing at all. Creation concerns, first of all, the origin of the universe, not its temporal beginning. Bit of a subtle point at the end there. Anyway, so a lot of stuff, there's a lot of theology in there. It's actually a summary of what Thomas Aquinas was saying in the 13th century, if you want to know. So it's not some reaction against, you know, 19th century science and evolution or anything like that. This is just theology that's been around for a very long time indeed. And like I say, for me, talking about God as the author, it sort of helps us to unpackage that a little bit, the sense of God writing that whole book, if you like. And so sometimes my secular colleagues in the Sandwich community say, well, you know, what difference does it really make to you to be a Christian or to believe in God? You know, I mean, our science is the same. We all do the same science. So what difference does it make? And I always just say basically the same kind of thing. You know, there wouldn't be anything to describe. We wouldn't be here. Nothing would exist, okay? So creation is primarily, first of all, about the claim there is a mind behind the universe, an intelligible mind, which makes an intelligible universe, which is why science is possible, because science can only be possible if we have wonderful mathematical equations like the one I just showed you, which, by the way, just for your interest, is called Schrödinger's equation and describes the fundamental properties of matter. Wow. How can you do that just by scribbling that up on a whiteboard or a blackboard? And that tells you immediately, doesn't it, something about the intelligibility of the universe in which we live. And that's the kind of universe that Christians believe there is a mind behind it all. And therefore, that mind, we would want to say, is God. Now, when you come to the New Testament, it goes a step further here. And this is really mind-blowing, I think. Okay, so because in the New Testament, it says, for the Old Testament, it talks about God, you know, the great creator being involved in all kinds of things all the way through, sustaining, upholding, writing the book of creation. You come to the New Testament, it says Jesus, the Son of God, is intimately involved in all of that, in all of that creation. So you go to the introduction to John's Gospel, and it says there that through the Logos, that is through Christ, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. An unbelievable claim, really, isn't it? Unbelievable claim. And you go on to read the epistles written by the Apostle Paul in this case. He's here writing to the church in Colossae, in Greece. And he says that by the Son of God, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together or consist. That's where this sort of sense of authorship comes in, isn't it? You've got this sense of ongoing, upholding, sustaining, creating. Creation is not just something that happens in the past, but is ongoing creation all the time, and there will be a new creation as well, past, present, future. So creation has three tenses in the Bible. And some people have made this sort of picture of God as what is God like as creator? He's like the composer and conductor of a symphony, great. Or you might want a jazz concert. You could take whatever music you want. Okay, but you've got all these different instruments, and there's the composer who's conducting at the same time and keeping the whole show on the road, upholding, sustaining all that is. And I just find some of these pictures kind of helpful to get my head around a little bit of what it means for God to be the creator. Charles Raven was the master of Christ College in Cambridge. You probably know that Darwin was up at my university, and he went up, in fact, originally to study theology, and he was going to be ordained in the Church of England, and in the end he didn't like that very much, and so he ended up as a naturalist, and that's the way it worked out. But this was this is in the 20th century. Charles Raven was the master of Christ College, and he has this lovely picture. He says, God as Father was like an artist deciding to create a picture. God the Son was the design on which the work was modeled. And the Holy Spirit was the creative energy in the artist that created the picture. So there you've got God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, all involved in this wonderful upholding and sustaining of the created order. And I think that's why I don't believe in the God of the gaps. And I want to just spend a couple of minutes just explaining what we mean by that term. So sometimes what happens, let's just look at this kind of yellow Swiss cheese there, okay? That represents all of our scientific knowledge we presently have, okay? So the white little holes represent the gaps in our present scientific knowledge, of which there are many, and of which we scientists are very happy about, because otherwise we wouldn't have a job, okay? So it's important to have those holes there, right? Okay, and we're trying to fill up the holes. And, some people have, and perhaps this happens with some religious believers, and certainly happens with Richard Dawkins, have this sort of temptation that when there's a gap in our present scientific knowledge, they kind of plant their belief in God in that gap. Okay, that's why it's called the God of the gaps. We're talking about here the sorts of things that science are pretty good at, pretty good eventually understanding. I mean, right now, we don't really understand the origin of life. We've got some ideas, you know, pretty, I think, growing, they're getting better, but we still definitely don't understand how life got going on this planet. So people say, ah, that's the bit that God does, okay. Well, yeah, but, you know, eventually I think biochemists and others will get there and will probably have a greater understanding of how that works and so forth. Where does the first cell come from? Actually, that's quite relatively easy, but that's a gap, and people want to label that with God and so forth. So that's the God of the gaps, okay. And of course, you can see the problem with that idea. Mostly, I mean, I just think it's a theological problem. If you go back to a wonderful commentary written by Augustine, which came out around 405, 410 AD, this is Augustine Hippo, one of these famous early church fathers. He said, nature is what God does. Okay, nature is what God does. This comes back to authorship. Okay, so if God is the author of the whole of creation, then why should it be the case that my scientific ignorance in the year 2019 should have any relevance, okay, to that belief in God as creator? I don't get the point, okay. And you know, you can see also there's a real practical problem here. Also, if you put your trust in a God of the gaps, well, the gaps are going to fill with scientific knowledge after a bit. They will. Okay, you might have to hang around a bit, but eventually we'll get there, okay? And then what happens to your concept of God? You know, if your God is so limited to those little gaps. So that's, I mean, pragmatically, it's just not a very good position to be in. And unfortunately, when I read the God delusion that Amy mentioned earlier by Richard Dawkins, people like that, it seems to me that the God he doesn't believe in is the God of the gaps. Well, now I think, well, I'm an atheist as well, because I don't believe in the God of the gaps. So I'm an atheist like Dawkins who doesn't believe in the God of the gaps. Does that make sense? Okay, so I mean, we're all atheists with regard to some concept of God or other, okay? And, you know, so the God I believe is the author of the whole created order and so forth. And that means we can now ask the question, if you take that as your framework, well, in that case, what do scientists do? Sometimes God is called the primary cause. He's the one, as I say, who's underlying, unsustaining all that exists. And so what do we do in science? We're investigating what Aquinas, again, coming back to him, called the secondary causes whereby they exist. In other words, secondary causes are all those means whereby God brings about his creation, the mechanisms, the material, you know, all those wonderful equations, scientific laws, whatever. Those are the secondary causes whereby they exist. And so we as scientists can investigate those. We can look at those, try and understand them. We can't investigate God. How can we do that? But we can investigate all of that stuff that God keeps on the road and keeps sustaining and keeps upholding and so forth. And, of course, for us biologists, that is really exciting. Now, does that mean, so sometimes wrong ideas can come into this sort of picture of the God as creator that I'm painting for you this evening. Is somehow God the divine puppet master, you know, kind of controlling every event? And I would want to say no. In the biblical understanding of God as creator, God gives the creation its own integrity, if you like. It's got its own autonomy in the sense that it operates according to its own principles that he's given to it. Remember, God causes creatures to be causes, okay? So causality is built into all the material and living and dead of the world. All causality applies to that. So it has its own reproducibility, its own consistency. And that's why we can do science. If it didn't have reproducibility, we wouldn't know where we were, okay? We hope the experiment we do this week will be the same next week as well. That's not always the case, but that's what we hope, right? So God is not a divine puppet master. He's given us genuine free will. He's given us his wonderful ability to make moral choices and so forth. But the whole of the material and energy and everything else is part of that great book of creation that he keeps going. So what I want to say this evening, really, is that there are two sort of narratives, if you like, here. We've got the narrative provided by theology, which is saying, well, why did God do creation in this particular way of living matter through evolution? What's the whole point, you know, of this 3.8 billion year wonderful, amazing evolutionary process? I mean, what's the point of it being there? But there's another narrative, which is in parallel, it's complementary, you need them both. And that's the one supplied by science, by biologists, saying, well, how did God do it? What are the mechanisms involved? And that's an ongoing discussion and plenty of new material coming in and plenty of adjustments to Darwinian theory. And there's a great discussion going on right now as to whether Darwin's theory is complete or whether we need new elements of that. So there's always going to be discussions about these theories. But the point I want to make here is that I think these are complementary, they're parallel. We need them both if we're going to really do justice to the complexity of life. So in a couple of minutes, we're going to have some questions. Just before we get there, let me just pick up. I think I've got 1 minute left, maybe 2 minutes. So one of the things that people often raise is, well, isn't evolution a chance process? How can you possibly bring that into, how can it be consistent with the idea that God has a purpose and a plan, for the whole evolutionary process? I just want to give you a little analogy here, which maybe you might find helpful. Let's just say, this is a question for you. Let's just say government wants to design a system to take money from a lot of people for very good causes, including themselves, in the process making a few people very rich. Well, how should they design that sort of process? Well, I'm sure you guessed it probably already in your minds. The National Lottery does precisely that, okay? It just takes money from a lot of people, often people who can't afford it, and that makes a few people very rich. And the key thing, obviously, is it gives a nice cut to the government at the same time. The point here, of course, is that is a design process that's using a randomized device to bring about conclusions, outcomes, which are absolutely certain. Definitely, if someone doesn't win the lottery this week, they will the next week. Okay, so it's well designed, but it's utilizing, if you like, a chance process to bring about exactly what God wants in this particular case. So what I find interesting here, of course, any biological evolutionist will agree with that point, really, and I'm very glad to say I'm singing from the same song sheet as Richard Dawkins on this particular point. So if you go way back to one of his earlier books, A Blind Watchmaker, in the preface he says, one of my tasks will be to destroy this eagerly believed myth that Darwinism is a theory of chance. We have seen, he says, that living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed to have come into existence by chance. Exactly right, exactly right. So when we look at the whole evolutionary process, it's very conserved, it's very constrained, it's very law-like, and it's the way it works out. And I just want to give you one example of that, and that is the example of convergence. Convergence means that when you got the same thing appearing again and again and again in evolutionary history, but it's under independent evolutionary lineages. Okay, and the classic example there is eyes. So compound and camera eyes taken together have evolved more than 20 times over the history of evolution separately, one after the other. You look at the eyes of an octopus, wow, they look very like ours, actually. Okay, it's quite remarkable. And so that's just one example of what's called convergence, one example of the way that evolution is moving in a certain direction. If you live on planet Earth, in this particular planet, you're going to get eyes. Okay, they'll crop up. They will. You just have to wait a bit. Okay, so, and if you go and live in a cave for a very long time, you're going to lose them. So don't do that either. But you have to wait a long time for that. Anyway, so, and it so happens, as it happens, that I published a book last year, which happens to be on the bookstall, and that's called "Is There Purpose in Biology?" And it's about many, many examples of this kind of constraint and how, things all kind of converge together in a certain kind of a directionality during the evolutionary process. It's also, by the way, it's got a whole chapter there about, well, how could God possibly use such an evolutionary process which is so full of suffering? And it has a chapter on that too for your interest. So I would say, is evolution atheistic? No, not in my book. And, I perhaps should mention, I became a Christian when I was 13, quite young. So when I went into really A-level biology and then going to study biochemistry at university and stuff, I was already a biologist and a Christian. I just sort of seen them growing together and just being both part of my life, really. I'm passionate about both. I'm passionate about evolution, more passionate about God than evolution. But, they're just sort of part of the same story, part of my life, and they just go very well together. So that's what I really want to say. And just finish again, coming back to what Charles Darwin said, it seems to be absurd to doubt that a man may be an ardent theist and an evolutionist. And I do agree with Darwin on this point. So thank you very much for your attention. So, yeah. And I just will have to plug the other book there. If you are interested in the whole relationship between creation and evolution, there is a book on the bookstall there, Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? And, well, I think I've claimed the answer is no, we don't, but there's a little more in that book about that. So thank you.
We promised you more information about our upcoming event, so here it is. The Second Thought will take place on 27th of March at 7 p.m. at Gallery Church in the Custard Factory, Digbeth, Birmingham. We will be exploring the historical relationship between the church and the scientific community with the Right Reverend Dr. David Thompson of Durham University. Head to our Eventbrite page for tickets. It's just £10 or £7.50 for concessions, and that includes one of our very swanky notebooks. And there'll be a free beer or hot drink for you once you're inside. We'd love to see you at Gallery Church on 27th of March, so search Thought on Eventbrite to find tickets.